When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. Listeners, we've got one of my favorite all-time guests returning this week. It is the Dutch chess legend, Grandmaster Jan Timman. Of course, he was an elite player in the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s. He played Anatoly Karpov for the FIDE World Championship in 1993. Nine-time Dutch champion. He's also a prolific and renowned author. His 2017 book, Timman's Titans, won ECF Book of the Year. It's also a personal favorite of mine. His new book, The Best Games of Max Uwe, is fairly self-explanatory in terms of what it covers. He reviews the games of his Dutch compatriot and mentor, fellow Dutch chess legend. There's some beautiful games in it. It is a highly worthwhile book that you will hear us discuss momentarily. We also discuss the modern chess scene and Magnus Carlsen and Hans Niemann, and he tells some great stories as always. So it's always such an honor to get to hear Grandmaster Jan Timman talk chess. And we will get you to that momentarily, but I wanted to give a shout out to our presenting chess education sponsors, Chessable.com. They continue to roll out new courses, including Simplified, The Carol Khan by I.M. Alex Banzea. I also wanted to give a shout out to Maurice Ashley's highly regarded course, Secrets of Chess Geometry. And you can check out my own recommended courses, which I will link to in the show description. Did want to mention, Again, YouTube listeners probably have figured out, or YouTube viewers, but this one is audio only. When I do interviews with Grandmaster Jan Timman, we usually do it with me calling him on the phone. So we will be back to the video format next week. But in the meantime, please enjoy this. As always, fascinating interview with the Dutch legend of chess, Grandmaster Jan Timman. Here it is. And we are here with the legendary Dutch champion and award-winning author, Grandmaster Jan Timman. Jan, it is a pleasure to speak again. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's also my pleasure. Yeah.
And I've been enjoying your new book, as I do all of your books, this one about the world champion, Max Uwe. And you've written, so we should be clear for listeners, this is a game collection, and there's some beautiful games in this. I really enjoyed checking out this book, but there's not as much prose as some of your more recent books. And in fact, you say in the introduction that for your personal recollections of Max Uwe, you should go to your classic book, Timman's Titans. And I thought it might be fun to start off with your first encounter with Max Uwe, which, correct me if I'm wrong, but you played a simul against him in The Hague when you were 11 years old?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, true.
So what are your memories of that specific encounter?
Well, actually, he was younger than I am at the moment. So, but I, of course, considered him as a very old man at the time, which is quite understandable. But, of course, I had a lot of respect for him. And I got to know him, of course. But no, I didn't know him at the time. But, of course, he knew my my parents, because my mother got the mathematics at school. So he was, she was one of his pupils, and my father also knew him from the mathematical center in Amsterdam, because my father was a mathematician, so as Erwin was. And I got to know him better when I was about 18 years old.
You describe the game a little bit and share what you recall of it, share some details from your older brother playing against him. Do you have any other recollections of that specific Simo? I mean, he must have felt larger than life at the time.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, no, I remember that when I played him, of course, I played a bit timid and he got an advantage. And but somehow he let it slip away and then he offered to draw. And that I was very happy with that.
Of course.
You know, I played him another time. It is not in my book, Timon Titus, because I didn't remember at the time, but there was a game that we played Blitz in 1971. We played both in the Dutch Blitz Championship at the time. Somewhere, I think it was in Hilversum. And so I saw the photo that we were playing Blitz, and then I remembered. It was a game, in this time I had white, and it was an open Ruy Lopez. I could see it from the from the picture.
Is that the photo that's in the book?
No, no. Actually, I didn't choose that photo to be in the book because, I thought there was a better photo. Actually, in that Blitz Championship, I won the game and I won the championship, and he awarded me the first prize, which is also, that's also a photo of that. But in the book, I chose for a photograph from 1979. We saw each other quite often then, because he was also a part of the Timman committee that helped me in my fight for the world championship. And he was very instrumental in that. And we were on very good terms at that time.
Okay, yeah, and by that point, he had already been FIDE president.
Yes, yes, he was already ex-FIDE president at the time, 1979.
Okay, and in your follow-up encounters that you described prior to his being FIDE president, you guys were born 50 years apart, probably the two most famous Dutch players in history. At what point did you start to develop a sort of personal relationship?
I think we started to develop this relationship in 1971, just around the time when we played this Blitz game, because I was also involved in some other projects. Like I went to a training camp in the Soviet Union, which was arranged by him, and we saw each other on different occasions. And of course, I got to know him very well around 1976, when I grew stronger and I was getting involved in the World Championship.
Okay, and what are your memories of this training camp in the Soviet Union?
Well, actually, he was, of course, he didn't join me there, but I went to Tbilisi to play a tournament, and then I had to spend some days in Moscow at training from Kasin, Alexander Kasin, who died not so long ago.
Okay, and were there other students there as well, or was it primarily...
No, I was alone there.
Okay. What was that like? So you were about 19, 20? How old?
Yes, I was 19 years old at that time. Yep. I had actually... there was also another... they had some sort of training fund for young players, which was sponsored by someone, and basically all this was arranged by Irwin that youngsters could go to the Soviet Union for this training camp. I think that after me, van der Stern was also selected to do that and also got in touch with Ergo about that.
Okay. And of course, obviously, the legendary Soviet chess school, quote unquote, has come up a lot on the podcast. I've gotten to interview a lot of Soviet emigres, and they talk more about the culture than the curriculum. Was the instruction you got when you went to this training camp, was that markedly different than how you had been approaching chess in the West?
I don't know. I don't think so. Actually, I think that Alexander Kasin was just a very nice man, but... I don't think that they were very keen on learning me some specifics about how to train best or how to play very well. I don't think so.
Okay, yeah, that echoes what Alex Yermolinsky said, that it was more about the sort of, that it permeated the atmosphere rather than that you were actually being taught secrets.
Yes, of course. Now, that was really not the point. I think that for me, this time was more memorable from what I experienced than from a chess point of view.
So, could you elaborate on that?
Well, I was in the Soviet Union, basically, for the second time, actually. And, I got to know people, and it's just a whole different atmosphere, different sort of life that I didn't know very well from the West. But the people were very nice that I got to know.
And at that age, were you already speaking English so well as you do now? And did you speak any Russian?
No, I didn't speak any Russian, but my English was more or less okay, if I remember well.
And were you able to get around okay with English?
Yes, because in general, I traveled a lot already since I was 16 years old. So I picked up a lot of English on the way, and German, of course, as well. And with some people, I spoke German in the Soviet Union.
And were you able to have any fun on that trip? It strikes me as quite daunting, you know, 19 years old, don't speak the language, sort of an intimidating government structure. What are your personal memories of that trip?
Well, yes, I just, as I said, I got to know the people that were very kind to me.
Glad to hear it.
Yes.
And bringing it back to Max Uriwe, you write in Timmins Titans of the book with a blue cover as a kid, that this was a formative chess book for you, a game collection of his. So what specifically do you remember about reading that book as one of your first chess books?
The main thing that I remember were actually the diagrams, because I didn't really play through all the games, but I just looked at the games and the text, of course, in Dutch, and that was very instructive and very interesting for me. I knew Erwe's books because my father had the whole collection of books of Erwe from before the war. He had this series of openings books, they're all from 1938, if I remember well, and also, of course, this book on Erwe, and there was also 300 Schachpartien from Tarasch. And all these books were available at my parents' home. So I never had a dull moment when I was studying chess.
And did you spend a lot of time reading these books?
Yes, that is true. I also liked 300 Schachpartien by Tarasch.
And were you generally getting out a chess set when you read these books?
I think I learned quite a lot, yeah.
But were you playing through the moves?
I think the most of the book about Botvinnik's games. Okay. It was a book in Dutch. It was translated into Dutch by Hans Müller. It was originally in German.
And a lot of the games, correct me if I'm wrong, but in those days, the annotations were typically pretty light, correct?
Yes, that is true, yeah. And of course, I had the chance to check them now, and the computer sees completely different things from what people thought at the time.
Right, and I know that you've done that with Max Uriwe's games as well. What would you describe as the sort of overall judgment of the computer of his games?
Of course, I used the computer also to select the games, to make a careful selection, and I discarded some games that are quite well known, which I believe were not really his best games. For example, against Snosko Borowski, where he is black and he wins by a combination, but I think the play was not very convincing in the middle game, because both players didn't really know how to handle the Scheveninger variation of the Sicilian. So I had to drop that game, which was of course a bit difficult, but there was nothing to do about it. Even I didn't know if I needed the computer to find out that the game was not very good. On the other hand, I found games that were surprisingly good and that I didn't know. For example, a game that he beat Fascia Pirch. You can find it in the book. It's in the last chapter after the war.
And you reference the website Chess Metrics a couple times as you're comparing players. How do you think about sort of, as in this modern era, the sort of quantitative, our ability to try to quantitatively evaluate players? Do you find that useful?
Yes, I think so. Of course, it is not always accurate, I believe, what Chess Metrics do. But it is the only way we can have a picture of who was the strongest at the time. I was a bit surprised, for example, by the fact that Myroxi was the strongest player, let's say, in the beginning of the previous century. Also, I was surprised that Bogoliubov was doing so well.
Yeah, you wrote that he was the strongest. Was it the late 1920s?
Yes. He had some very good results, and he won some big tournaments. But in general, I don't think he was such a great player.
Yeah, it's fascinating to go through that, and it is interesting how perceptions get formed. Of course, a major one with Max Ohre being that he's one of the weaker world champions. Do you find that, after having done this extensive study, do you find that to be a fair characterization?
It's hard to say. I think that all world champions were really strong. But of course, he was living in the time of Capablanca and Aliakhin, who were really incredibly strong. And apart from Lasker, was also quite strong. I had a lot of difficulty to play Lasker. He lost 3 times against him.
And we had a question from a Patreon supporter of the podcast, Marco Bulatovic. Thanks for supporting the pod, Marco. And on that note, he also asked, like, what contributed to that notion? Your Dutch compatriot, Willie Hendricks, has, of course, written about how sort of these narratives get written by showing up in one book early and then sort of being, whether consciously or not, sort of parroted in subsequent books. Do you think that there was some of that with Ohre?
Well, I think that there was just very little known about Ohre's games. There were not so many commentaries apart from the book From My Games, which actually went only to 1937, the second match against Aliakhin. And I believe that his career afterwards was also quite interesting. For example, the match that he played against Bogoliubov in Karlsbad 1941. He was criticized for that because that was, of course, German-occupied territory. But he played very well there. He was 40 years of age. And I think that he was quite strong. And and also in 1946, when he was already 45 years old, he played very well in Groningen.
Yeah, and amazing that he was able to play at that level while having a day job.
Yes, of course. Yeah, especially if you take into account that Botvinnik was 10 years younger, and he always won the tournament.
Yeah, really impressive. And, of course, getting to the perception of Ohre, a lot of it obviously comes down to sort of, the traditional narrative about the world championship match against Aliakhin himself, where everyone... where it's commonly argued that Aliakhin was excessively drunk the entire time. You address this briefly in your book, but how do you evaluate that sort of narrative?
Well, I think that Aliakhin had the habit to drink a lot in general, and he got away with it. It didn't influence his chess that much. Of course, once you get a bit older, this may... have a negative influence, and you can possibly better cope with it when you're younger. But Ohre said that Aliakhin didn't drink more than he normally would. And, well, you must take into account that he had carte blanche in the Carlton Hotel. Very clever move by the Uber committee who organized the match.
How do you mean? Like he had like an open bar?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Wow.
He could drink whatever he want.
And he did.
Yes, for sure. Yeah. But he was used to that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's definitely a point that I think you highlight well in the book, that that was just another day in the life for Aljek, and there was nothing extraordinary about that that match.
No, I think that, that basically in 1937, he probably had good reasons to refrain from alcohol.
Right.
He probably had too much in his life.
Yeah. And then he cleaned up for the subsequent match.
Yes.
Let's talk a bit about Max Aubry's playing style. I mean, you allude to this proclivity for sacrifices on vacant squares, you say, as pointed out by Raymond Keene. And, you know, this famous knight f7 move in Zurich and, of course, rook h8 also in Zurich against Geller, probably one of his most famous games of all time. And there's definitely a creativity that's really striking as you play through these games. Did you ever have any conversations with Max about his approach to studying chess? Like, where do you think this creativity came from?
Well, and that's really a pity that he died at the moment when I think I could still have had a lot of conversations with him. He didn't get very old. If you look at his lifestyle, he only got 80 years old. So, and if he would have been older, I would certainly have had the opportunity to talk about that. But I think he had a very unique talent for chess. And he also liked very much to play chess. You see, a lot of pleasure. Just look at the games and you see that he had a lot of pleasure playing. And you cannot say this about all world champions. I think, for example, he got much more pleasure out of chess than Capablanca, for example.
Interesting. And you feel that you can sense that even playing through their games?
Yes. I think so, yeah. I think Capablanca, he had the tendency to get bored. Aljekin was, of course, a different matter. He just lived for chess. Chess was everything for him.
And, of course, you've written about so many other world champions. How would you compare these gentlemen to, say, Karpov?
Completely different from Aljekin, yeah. Karpov simply liked to play games. And Aljekin had a more scientific approach, was much more interested in opening series, for example. And Karpov really just wanted to play a game, like he would play any card game, and to be very good at it. And he had an excellent drive to be the best, to beat his opponents.
But you've written, didn't work as hard as someone like Kasparov.
No. I think hardly anyone. Yeah, nowadays, of course, people work just as hard as Kasparov did. But nobody else did, I think, at the time, for my generation.
And obviously you've written about your personal interactions with Mikhail Tal. How would you describe his approach to chess? Not over the board, but like how it fit into his life.
I think that he was completely hooked on chess. Of course, also some other things, women, alcohol, and mostly strong alcohol, just hard liquor. And chess was also part of that, but he lived for that, yeah. He liked to play, and he also liked to analyze, he liked to play blitz, and he was very adventurous, let's put it this way.
Yeah,
I knew Tal quite well. Yeah, we had a lot of conversations about all sorts of things. It was always very good company.
Yeah, one gets that impression for sure. And another question on Max Uwe that I think is important to discuss. You write about in your book his propensity for making silly blunders. You quote him saying, "I've made more silly blunders than any other world champion." Do you have any theories on why that was the case?
It's very hard to explain. I think that he must have been nervous at some point. For example, when he blundered against Smyslov in a winning position in the World Championship in 1948, there was really absolute no reason to do that. It was a great game that he was playing, and he spoiled everything. And it's very hard to understand, because normally he would be quite good in accurately calculating variations, but that time it just collapsed. And, well, there are other examples, and I just mentioned a few. Of course, they didn't find their way in the book, because he just blundered these games away. For example, against Lilienthal in 1937 in the Stockholm Olympiad. He had a completely winning ending, and it was a very fine game, brilliant game. It's a pity he did that. He just spoiled everything. And otherwise, this would also have been a great game for the book.
But you never, so you do have this quote where he admits or concedes that he had, that he made more blunders than he would like. But did you ever either personally discuss with him or read anything where he sort of goes deeper into what the cause might have been?
Well, yes, he wrote about it in after the candidates tournament in Zurich. He wrote an article in Dutch. And I don't know, he doesn't really explain why he blundered this game against Smyslov, but he actually explained it a little bit. Yes, he said that he was somehow over-optimistic.
Okay, yeah.
Yes, that was the main explanation that he gave. He thought, well, I have already 2 out of 2, which was actually quite impressive. He was 52 years old. He had just beaten Kotov and Geller. And then in the third round, he was beating Smyslov. So he was at some point, he just miscalculated. He just got carried away. He was too over-optimistic, something like that. But it's not typical for his way of life or his style in life, not at all.
Right. You write about him being sort of a very meticulous guy, generally.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's actually the way to say it, yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting dichotomy. And we have so many topics I'd like to ask you about. So to sort of close the loop on Max Uribe again, I definitely highly recommend this book. I mean, the games are just a pleasure to play through. And as you suggest might happen, it did change my perception of him. Do you have a number one favorite game after having spent, I know we talked about you working on this project back in 2021, so after having spent some years going through these games in such detail?
Yes, well, of course, I still find the game against Geller from the candidates tournament really very impressive with Rook H8.
Yeah.
And I saw now that in the new book by Settler, This move gets a question mark, but I think this is funny. Wrong. And you cannot do that. I mean, that's not the way to annotate games, in my opinion. Doesn't matter what the computer thinks is the strongest move. This was actually the best move in the position, and it won very quickly. I think that was a great game. I also like, of course, the Pearl of Zandvoort, where he beats Aljakain, and the game against Nydorf. But some other games are also very good. I mean, I just want to draw your attention to his win, for example, against Sultan Khan, which is a very unknown game. The game that I mentioned before against Pirc is very good. These are quiet positional games that are very impressive. And you will find a lot of them against Joner. There's a very impressive technical game where he just outplays his opponent very systematically.
Yeah, I mean, the Pearl of Zandvoort, as you allude to, and the amazing Rook H8 move, like those tend to get more attention because they're a little flashier, but...
Yes. But I like both Urbis. I like the Urbis who wants to attack, and he really loves to attack. That is quite sure. And I also like the Urbis who's very positional.
We'll be right back to hear Grandmaster Jan Timman's thoughts on the World Championship and much more.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And we are back. If you don't mind, Jan, I'd also like to discuss the World Championship. I know that you gave a speech at the Max Loewe Center there in Amsterdam. Or I believe you gave some game analysis, as what Erwin Lamy told me as we did a postmortem of the match. Is that correct?
Yes, that's true, yeah. I spent many hours there at the Loewe Center, and it was fully packed, and just trying to explain the happenings in the final game between Ding Liren and Nepomniachtchi. And it was an interesting game.
Yeah, so this is the final classical game?
Yes, that's true, yeah.
Okay. Well, let's return to the match in a second. First, I'd like to hear a bit more about the Max Loewe Center itself, because I know it has a lot of photos. Were you able to make use of this center for any of your research?
At the time when I lived in Amsterdam, I went there quite often for research. But also, for example, when I was writing books, for example, The Longest Game, and also about Over, sometimes I would just send them a message to look something up for me. Because I don't have all the material at home here. I have many books, and I used my library to write my books, but it's not always sufficient.
Yeah, that makes sense. Do you know any idea how many chess books you have? I'm sure some have passed through your possession over the years as well.
I think that I have about 2,500.
Oh, wow. That's impressive. That must be a lot of fun.
Yes, I have all the books at the attic now. It's my library. And I'm now doing a very systematic research how to put them just in the right order.
Do you have a personal favorite from your collection?
Well, yes. As I said, Draaien om de Schachpartien is a favorite. Also, the book with Reti's studies is one of my favorite books.
Okay. We'll have to check that out. And okay, so returning to the World Championship, in one of our prior interviews, you mentioned being a fan of Ding Liren's playing style. Did you feel like this match was representative of his
style?
Well,
in the beginning, he was very uncertain. He had to get self-confidence. Afterwards, we could see that he's really very strong. But he was still nervous from time to time. And this is really a pity. I believe that he can still become stronger if he's focusing and if he's working very hard.
Yeah, it sounded in some post-match interviews like he now that he won the World Championship, he sort of made it sound like now he would begin to get very, very sort of professional, which...
Yeah, now he wanted to become the strongest player in the world. This is the first world champion who said that.
Right,
because,
yeah.
For example, Petrosyan may have had this feeling as well. Although he actually won the candidates' tournaments, of course, in 62. But in the years of his world championship, he was not, he couldn't prove that he was the strongest player. Now we have to see how Ding Liren will do. But of course, he shouldn't have played so soon after a world championship match. Same for Nepomniachtchi. This is they underestimated how much energy it takes.
Yeah, I couldn't believe they were playing a tournament five days later.
It's very hard. I know from my own experience that it is very hard. You need time to recover from such a match.
Yeah, and it feels like these days there's so many opportunities to play. Like probably in your day there was a bit more of a necessity.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, I didn't play so much actually, especially not when I was playing these matches for the World Championship. But of course, things were completely different at the time.
And what other thoughts did you have about the World Championship? Did you watch the match live, and what did you think of the opening approaches? I'd just love to hear your big picture thoughts about this match.
Yes, I of course I followed the games live. Yeah, as I do with all the major tournaments. I don't follow the rapid and blitz tournaments, but I follow the classical tournaments and also the match. And I thought it was interesting from opening's point of view. I think that there were especially. Ding Liren had a lot of different ideas what to play. For example, this game that he lost in the French defense, he played very well and he understood the French, although he hadn't played it before. I think something like it, that is quite remarkable in the World Championship.
Yeah, certainly some surprising choices from my perspective. And how do you assess the rest of the World Championship candidate cycle? Like, what do you think of Magnus's decision to step down? And do you think, obviously, he's, as we record this on Tuesday, June 20th, he's coming off of a slightly disappointing tournament. Do you think he'll be able to regain his form?
Yes, I think that he can do that, but it just depends on his attitude. I think he needs focus, he needs motivation. And once he has his focus and motivation, he will automatically start to work harder. What he said after the game was sometimes, well, I just wanted to avoid Siri, otherwise my opponent would know everything. And that's not the kind of comment you must make. Yeah, but, you can see that, for example, a successful player like Caruana works extremely hard, although it's very hard to understand why he made that strange error in the last game against Nakamura.
Yeah, that was surprising.
I knew this position quite well, and I knew that Black had very little to fear there. And there were six games, is it? So something very strange happened. And I have not seen an explanation for that, but in general, a player like Caruana, he's working hard enough to win games, and you really need to do that. And I think that Carlsen needs to get some real challenges. But it's a pity that we still have this format of candidates' matches and the World Championship match, candidates' tournament and World Championship match. I think that it would be much better if we had a World Championship tournament. 10 players double round.
Yeah, I saw that you suggested that in your column in New in Chess magazine.
Correct.
I was a bit surprised because don't you? I personally, as a chess fan, like I really enjoy the spectacle of the one-on-one match. Would you miss that at all?
I will also miss that. But the point is that I just see no other way of getting Magnus back in the fight for the world championship. Let's give an example. He will play the World Cup. Okay, he might do that very well there. You don't win the world title if you win the World Cup. You get qualified for the candidates tournament. and I don't think he will play. And we will always be dissatisfied as long as he's there and he recovers from this bad tournament that he played. Well, it's the same as what happened with Kasparov. After Kramnik became world champion, Kasparov continued to play very well, and there was no match between Kramnik and Kasparov. That is somehow uneasy. But I think that once we have Carlsen back as world champion, in that case, if there will be a tournament, then I think they should start playing matches again, because the other players like Gukesh will be a bit older and will be a real challenge for the world title.
Yeah, it's kind of an in-between period right now. But Magnus has suggested some formats, some more radical than others. But like one I recall seeing him suggest is, instead of it being 1 4-hour game per day, 2 game 60 days per day, so that it slightly lessens the amount of preparation that someone can bring to the table, and allows you to play a match with more games. But of course, the quality would go down with less time. What do you think of suggestions like that?
No, I'm not very fortunate. No, I'm not very much in favor of that, because I think in general the classical chess is important to keep it. We have to keep it, because it is just the highest standard of chess, and it shouldn't be lost. If you look at any games that I play at the highest speed, the level goes down, and it's really a pity.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, and of course he has written and said that he likes Fischer Random classical chess, but I don't know. To me, that seems like too big a change. Do you agree for it to be the actual world championship?
I don't like Fischer Random at all. I have no sympathy for Fischer Random. I think it's just a mistake. I mean, we should also realize that Fischer never played it himself. Yeah,
right.
But I think in general we have this whole history coming from the Middle Ages, from the Renaissance, where the order of the pieces is like it is. And there's a lot of harmony in there.
Yeah, so even as someone who, as we discussed in a prior interview, you've written that given the amount of preparation required, you're not sure if you would have been a professional under these circumstances. But nonetheless, you don't feel like the rules should be changed too much.
Yeah, that is true. I wouldn't be a professional. I would probably have done something else in life, writing books, because you don't need to learn so much for that.
Okay. And we have a question on that theme from Brian Karen, patron supporter of the pod and founder of the Facebook Chessbook Collector Group. And Brian writes, he says, it's clear that modern GMs are stronger in the opening and other areas due to superior data and training tools. But he wonders if you think there are areas of chess that grandmasters of your generation are nearly equal to or even better than modern GMs at.
Well, I think in general, the top players of my generation and older players were a little bit better in the end game. After Vacanze this year, I wrote an article in New in Chess, you may have seen, about rook end games that were played in Vacanze, and too many mistakes, actually. And it's quite understandable, because at that time, we had adjournments, we could study end games, and we didn't have to play just with a little bit of incremental eternity in one day. So it's different. I think for the middle game, it's hard to judge. I think we should. It's really necessary to make a very thorough analysis of that and compare, let's say, all the tournaments, all the matches with tournaments of nowadays. But as far as I know, it has never been done very systematically. Of course, the emphasis of the older players of the, let's say, the classical era was different. There was much more emphasis on positional play. Well, now there's more emphasis on sharp calculations. And the general ideas of the past don't apply anymore. The computer just has so many exceptions on these ideas that we learned from Botvinnik and other great players that it's completely different now. I find this very interesting to see because I work a lot with computers also when I analyze games from the present and the past for new in chess.
Yeah, and I think I remember you writing that with endgames in particular, it can be it's harder to understand what the computer's telling you.
That is also true, yes. I pointed that out. I spent a lot of time, in general, I spent a lot of time to understand why computers have a certain judgment about games, or also about endgame studies. When I make endgame studies, sometimes I simply don't understand what's going on. And I have to go step by step, and then I can understand what is deeply hidden in the position. This goes for games, it also goes for endgame studies. And this I find fascinating.
Yeah. And so you mentioned top players perhaps not being as strong as endgames, and I think it's very insightful what you point out about with adjournments in prior generations, there's a very distinct reason and motivation to go to study endgames in depth. But if a modern professional decided they wanted to make it a point of emphasis, what do you think would be the best way to study endgames?
I think in general, it's the best way to study rook endgames. I think that Erwin Lamy told me this recently, that Geary is now just spending a lot of time on endgames, on studying endgames. And also, I noticed that, for example, Magnus Carlsen must have spent a lot of time on endgames because he's quite good, actually, better than most other top players. But I think also sometimes, it's just a general feeling that in the past players were slightly better, because sometimes you see that, for example, Nepomniachtchi, when he beat Geary in the Candidates Tournament with Bis Black, he won an endgame that he had to work out on the board, which was very impressive. So I cannot say that it's a general rule that in the past people were better. But I think in general, it's possible nowadays with the table basis to study all these seven pieces and games, rook endings, and just get a general feeling. And of course, we have also very good books nowadays by John Nunn about these endings.
Yeah, the level of detail is staggering.
Yes.
In the rook endgame
books. John Lund did a very good job in general.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's Dvoretsky's endgame manual, which gets recommended here on the podcast quite frequently. Have you spent much time with that book?
No, because I just from another generation, when I studied endgames, it was mostly André Chiron and Ava Buck. And the Levenfish and Schmischler for rook endings, although now most of this is not so relevant anymore.
And in terms of, obviously, Geary is known for his facility with working with computers. Any guesses as he sort of tackles endgames? Do you think he's trying to memorize table-based positions or focusing more on understanding? Or how would you approach it as a professional?
Well, I must say that I make a lot of endgame studies now, and then I'm also very busy studying endgames for obvious reasons. But I try to do it for different purposes, not for playing, but just to discover beauty. But I'm not sure how I would go about it now if I would really be playing at top level. I would probably find a way, but I haven't given that much thought. It's probably better to ask someone like Geary.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think in general, Geary is a very good technical player.
When we come back, we will hear about Grandmaster Jan Timman's next book projects. And we are back. And on a related topic, we have another question from a supporter of the podcast. This one's from Gerard Hart, who writes, you wrote the Art of Chess Analysis in 1997, and he wonders, with chess engines now being updated, are you considering rewriting it for the 21st century?
Yes, it would be an interesting idea, yeah. But there are always too many topics that I want to write about. And if, let's say, the publisher would ask me to do that, I would do it.
And go ahead.
Could give some interesting results. But on the other hand, we were just looking at my old book about Spassky-Fischer 1972, and we wanted to make a new book with footnotes and just keeping the old book. And I came to the conclusion that it was impossible. I would have to write a completely new book because there would be too many footnotes, simply.
Or would these be based on the engine, or?
Yes, on the engine, yeah.
Okay. And I know that you've just finished your current project, but do you have thoughts of another book or what might be next?
Yeah, next book will probably be a book about endgame studies.
Oh, great. But not.
And also there will be, I have been working on a revised edition of The Art of the Endgame. And I've added 16 extra studies. And I have also corrected a lot of mistakes and just added some more material. And I hope that it will come out this autumn.
That's exciting. Both sound fantastic. And just to cover one other question from a listener, Chris Wainscott, friend of the podcast, asks for your best Lubomir Ljubojevic story. And Chris notes he's a character, and it seems like everyone from that generation has at least one great story about Lubo.
Oh, Lubo. Well, it's not so easy to think of a story now. Yeah, just something that... It pops up, yeah. I know Lubo could always get very excited, yeah, about things, something small things sometimes.
And you feature a game against him in Timmins Triumphs.
Yes, he was very emotional sometimes. I noticed that he had this habit of offering draws. Just when he got excited, or sometimes for no reason at all.
And would he do it, like, repeatedly within the span of one game, or just...
No, just one moment. But also, once I remember that he played something in the Ruy Lopez, he was white, and he came to me and he asked, is it all Siri what I play? And that was, I found it very funny.
Okay.
And I said, yes, it's very good when you play. I didn't know what to say, yeah.
Earlier when we were discussing the World Championship cycle, you mentioned Gukesh as a potential challenger. I know you've occasionally written about some of the young talents in your column. Do you have a favorite of the younger generation players?
Yeah, well, actually, Gukesh, you just mentioned him. Yeah, he's one of my favorites. Yeah, sure. Yeah. I would like to see him do well. Yeah, because he's a very interesting player.
What's interesting about him?
He has a lot of potential. He has a lot of ideas, and he's looking for the initiative very often, and he really goes for it. And I like that very much. On the other hand, I must also mention other people, of course, yeah, like Abdus Sattarov, who's also very promising. But for the moment, Gukesh is my favorite. And I must also say that although now he's not always doing so well, but I think that Hans Niemann is also a very interesting player.
What's interesting about his games to you?
Yeah, he's also a player who's looking for initiative, new ideas. And he's not always succeeding, but I think he can still make progress.
Okay.
If he gets to play top tournaments, of course.
Right. What did you think of that whole controversy?
Well, I think that... I don't see any proof that he has done anything unethical in a classical game. So So I don't see any point in discussing that. I have looked at games, but no, it was not very convincing. He just he beat Carlsen fair and square, I must say. And there was nothing wrong with that game. At some point, he missed a win and let Carlsen come back. So I don't see a point of suspecting any full play there.
Yeah, I felt the same way. Now, he has, as you mentioned, it would be good if he got more invitation to tournaments. I was glad to see, I don't know if you saw this, but he was awarded the Sanford Fellowship here in the United States, where he's given a stipend to at least pursue chess professionally. So I was glad to see that he's not blacklisted in that regard.
That is good, yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very sad situation now, yeah, true.
Yeah.
Because he's one of the very promising young American players.
Yeah, and he, as you allude to, he's been playing a ton. He just finished a tournament in Las Vegas, and before that, he was playing abroad. I believe it was in Dubai and elsewhere. And I saw someone suggest on Twitter that he's maybe even playing too much, and that made me wonder: do you think it's possible for like a 19, 20-year-old rising chess professional? Is it possible for them to play too much?
Yes, I think so, yeah. I think this may be a problem for him, because you always need to have fresh energy, fresh ideas. And sometimes, even if it doesn't matter what age you have, you can become exhausted. There's nothing to do about it. There shouldn't be too much chess in your head at some point.
Interesting. So do you have a sense of what the optimal balance would be in terms of like how much classical to play per year?
Oh, well, I think that Botvinnik once said that you have to play a maximum of 80 games per year. And normally that was also what I did in the past. And if you play 100, it's already a lot.
Yeah. I guess especially as you get older, because when Niemann did gain, when he made his sort of legendary jump, hundreds of points in a couple years, one thing is it was coming out of the pandemic, but he was playing like 150 games a year or more. I'm not positive on the number.
That is actually excessive. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's good that he was young.
Yeah, of course. Well, he's still young. Yeah.
Yeah.
He can afford a lot to do a lot. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and you know, a tangentially related question. You mentioned that you don't see evidence that he cheated in that game against Magnus. Have you ever played an over the board game where you felt that something foul was going on?
Well, it may have been, yeah, but I'm not sure. I never accused anyone. But you know that during open tournaments, well, there are always possibilities to cheat, and the organizers can hardly take any measures against that. But well, what can I say? It's just not in the. Not in the past, of course, no. But I think that it may have happened. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
It may happen much more often than we think.
Yeah, it's hard to know.
Yeah.
And Jan, do you think you'll compete again at some point, or would you consider yourself retired at this point?
Oh, no, sure, certainly not. But I don't see any tournaments to play at the moment. I'm not very keen on playing open tournaments where I have to play two games a day. I wanted to play the Open Dutch Championship, but it's taking place end of July, beginning of August, and it's terribly hot in the playing hall. They have no aircon. So for the time being, I see no opportunities to play something. But if something interesting pops up, I will play.
That's great to hear. We would love to see you back out there. And I had flagged another story I wanted to hear more about from Timmins Titans. There's always so many fantastic stories that one can come across in your writing. And you describe going to interview Garry Kasparov in 1997, and you contrast it with the conversation with Karpov. Do you still remember what it was like? You'd mentioned preparing for days for this interview to discuss games with Kasparov.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, we were basically discussing his games against Kuiper from these five matches that he played. And he had a very good memory. Yeah, sure. It's a pity I cannot find his material, because it would be interesting to see it again, what he said, because only part of this was emitted, was just broadcasted in the Netherlands in this television show that I had. But it's really pity I cannot find the material. But I was impressed by Kasparov, sure.
Yeah, you said that without prompting, he just started spouting various variations from all of these games from many years before.
Yes, that is true. And I did actually preparation for this interview, of course. I looked at games, and I hadn't written, of course, his book, The Longest Game, yet. That would be written much later. But I knew some things about the matches. But when he started, spouting out variations, then it was a bit difficult for me. I just had to let him finish that. And yes, it would be interesting to see this material. I couldn't find it also when I was writing The Longest Game. It would have been very helpful for me.
And did you?
But once I get hold of it, I will probably write about it for New Chess.
That would be great. We would love to see that. And
yes.
And of course, you played Kasparov many times. One of your most famous games being your 1985 win against him, where basically there at the end of the game, you know, this is audio only, so I'm just trying to describe it for listeners. But at the end of the game, there's a pin, but then you have a cross pin on the 41st move with Queen F6 that causes him to resign, and it's a beautiful tactic. And I'm just curious if you, obviously it's rare that one tactically gets the better of Kasparov. I'm curious if you had a conversation with him about that, if the clock was involved, because you do annotate it in Timmins Triumph, but you didn't expound on that particular game, that particular moment, that much.
Well, actually, I think that he was not in time trouble or anything. Not at all. I think that he was just over-optimistic, and he wanted to impress. He wanted to play impressive moves. But as I explained also on Timmons Night, is that I just made a horrible mistake, and I immediately realized it. I overlooked something. And that's actually also why I won the game. Otherwise, it might have been a draw.
Huh. But do you think he overlooked?
But I think actually that I discovered that I played a very good game against him in Manila 1992, this black. I played very well till a certain moment, also according to the computer, all the best moves. And I was completely winning with black. And then I started to make slight mistakes. And now when I look back at this game, I see that that it was not so difficult to win the game. And finally, it was a draw.
We'll be right back to wrap things up with Grandmaster Jan Timman and hear about how he is using engines today. And we are back. And obviously, you mentioned you're using the computer a lot for your work with endgame studies, for reviewing Max Uwe's games, and used it some in Timmins Titans, but in Timmins Triumphs, excuse me. How often do you ever just fire up the engine and look at one of your old games just on a whim?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Yes, that is true. Sometimes, yes, I look at old games that I played just randomly. Not for any, of course, much more intensely when I was writing Timmins Triumphs. Then I needed to find the best games, and it was a difficult choice sometimes. But on the other hand, yes, I learned a lot about all sorts of games that I played.
Wow, it must be fascinating to go through.
Yes, I love the computer, yeah. It's really fantastic to look at old games.
And do you try to have the most modern engine, or do you sort of feel like any 3500 level engine will do?
Yes, I think that I have Stockfish 14. I can probably try 15, but I don't think there's much difference.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
I'm happy now with Stockfish 14, but I must say also for endgame studies, sometimes also Stockfish 14 doesn't see the idea.
And then if you feed it the move, will it find it, or?
Sometimes, for some reason, sometimes it's impossible for the computer to find the right move, which I don't understand, actually.
And
but I will have to discuss this with somebody who has even a stronger computer.
Right. I know you mentioned sending positions to Erwin Lemie in the past. And
yeah, that's true. For Tim on Triumphs, I just sent him the manuscript and he discovered some things. I don't know which computer he used, I forgot, but he got some improvements, which were very valuable.
And are you playing around with the neural net computers as well, the Leelas? And I know some of the Stockfishes obviously are incorporating them now as well.
Well, actually, no, I just one computer is enough for me.
Okay.
But sometimes I look at what the old Fritz Trauf has to say about certain endgame studies, but that's normally not so impressive. I mean, it is really important to have a very strong computer to work on endgame studies.
And it's always such an honor to speak with you, Jan. One last topic. I'm just curious how you feel about the state of Dutch chess right now. I know Anish is doing quite well, consolidating and making a real push for the candidate. Are there any other top young talents or top players that you're excited to track?
Well, I think that Aileen Rubas is very promising. She was here for some training. I gave her two afternoons training sessions and. I may do this for some more training sessions in the future, but she's always traveling from one tournament to the other, so it's not that easy. But of course, Giri is still very strong, and Jordan van Vereist has been a bit disappointing, and I hope that he will be able to recover. But apart from that, I don't see any very strong players from the junior generation at the moment. But it may change.
And when you worked with Aileen Rubas, what sort of material did you present? Did you analyze games?
Yes, I looked at some games that she played, and also I showed some games for myself. I showed some endgame studies that I found useful. And we did concentrate on that. And she was accompanied by Robert Riss, who was her trainer.
Oh, okay.
You know him, yeah?
I'm familiar with his work, yeah.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, Jan, this has been a real pleasure, as always. The book, of course, is called The Best Games of Max Ore. Highly recommend it. Anything else to discuss before we say our goodbyes?
No, I think we discuss a lot, yeah. So it's fine with me.
Excellent. Well, I always appreciate the generosity of your time, and always look forward to the next book. So thank you so much, Jan. Really appreciate it.
Okay, I'd like to do the conversation. Bye-bye.
Podcast Network.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.